You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud.
Aloud and the Library Foundation project, Hollywood is a Verb, Los Angeles Tackles the Oxford English Dictionary, welcomes three brilliant and adventuresome writers to discuss how, through the etymology of words, the OED exhibits the shape-shifting nature of language across time. How does a dictionary bend to the task of describing our evolving human experience? And what is its role in recording and refereeing language variation and change? Is all change good? Our guests tonight will ponder how dictionaries support or inhibit the idiosyncratic use of language as a means for creative expression. John McWhorter teaches linguistics, music history, philosophy, and American studies at Columbia University. He is the author of Power of Babel, Doing Our Own Thing, Our Magnificent Bastard Tongue, The Untold History of English, What Language Is, and the upcoming Words on the Move. His academic specialty is language change and contact, and his academic books on language include Defining Creole and Language Interrupted. John also writes a monthly column on language for The Atlantic. Joining John in conversation is LA's own novelist Mark Z. Danielewski, author of the genre-busting novels House of Leaves, The Whale's Toe Letters, Only Revolutions, The 50-Year Sword, and The Familiar, a planned 27-volume series. His books are a unique combination of image and text, each carrying their own weight on the page. His novel, Only Revolutions, was a finalist for the 2006 National Book Award. And our interlocutor tonight is Howard A. Rodman, whose screenplay, Savage Grace, starring Julianne Moore and Eddie Redmayne, was nominated for Best Screenplay at the 2009 Spirit Awards, and August, starring Josh Arnett and David Bowie. He also wrote Joe Gold's Secret, based on the memoir by famed New York writer Joseph Mitchell. In 2013, Rodman was awarded the Chevalier of Arts and Letters, the highest honor given by the French government. Rodman is the president of the Writers Guild of America.
Thank you for that splendid and gracious set of introductions. Thank you all for being here tonight. And thank you, John, and thank you, Mark, for participating in this with us. What we're going to do is pretty straightforward. I'm going to indulge in some bankrupt sentimentality about the OED and what it meant to me. Then we're going to have discussions and questions with these guys, then we're going to open it up to questions from you. And then they're going to sign their books, and then we're all going to go home. and at some point, then, you know, we all die, but we won't go there tonight.
Let's start there.
Okay. If you were a four-eyed bohemian of a certain generation, the OED was a kind of grail, and at least for my generation, it meant one particular OED, which was the one that you got as a gift from Book of the Month Club if you signed up to read a certain number of great unread bestsellers. And the way it worked was they gave it to you sort of to entice you into a lifetime of literacy, and most of us kept the dictionary and did something else with the books. That's what those blankets on Astor Place were for. And The edition, and I don't know how many of you are familiar with it, was a very distinctive one. It was a two-volume set with tiny, tiny, tiny print. It was like, you know, if T.E. Lawrence had seven pillars of wisdom, we had two. And on the top of it was a pull-out drawer, very sort of Victorian, with a magnifying glass in it. The magnifying glass was not like round like Sherlock Holmes or Le Corbusier's spectacles, but it was rectangular. It sort of had the aspect ratio of the movies in it. And you needed that magnifying glass because in order to do the OED in two volumes, the print was very, very small. And there were, you know, severe limitations on it. You couldn't read it indoors, really, because even with a magnifying glass, the print was so small that it was hard to read without sufficient illumination. Yeah. And you couldn't read it out of doors because the magnifying glass would collimate the light and singe the pages. And so we didn't use the OED pretty much as a reference. We used it, you know, the way we would use drugs, recreationally. And I think part of the fun for us was sort of going through it and romping in what Nabokov would call the lexical playfields and finding out, because the OED not only had words and definitions, but it had first usages and it had etymologies, which not all of our other dictionaries had, or certainly didn't have to that degree. And, you know, you would get lost in things like, you know, why do the names for the outsides of animals like cow, pig, and sheep come from Norse or Germanic languages, where names of insides of animals, the parts we eat, like beef, pork, and mutton, come from Old French.
It's a fascinating story.
Yeah.
Yes, and you can learn it from the OED.
Look, yeah. I confess I had
Are
that.
We supposed to talk about it?
I mean, I had that exact set and with the magnifying glass, and the first word I looked up was fart. That was unusual. The usages that were back into the 1400s, 1300s, it made me feel very connected to the past.
I don't want.
And the present, mind you.
I don't want to take away from you your sense of being unique, but I think that's what we all did.
Exactly.
No. I do not remember looking up fart in the OED. I wanted to know more things like the business about the cow and the pig or where the word ought came from. Have you ever thought about ought? O-U-G-H-T. It's like a seal.
Oh!
And it looks kind of like somebody punched it. You don't think about the word ought much, but where did that come from? And the OED taught me that it came from owed. You owed somebody something. Ought was the past tense of owe. That's what I learned. I didn't learn about my functions, but I think that there's room for both of those.
So Mark and I were thinking about bodily functions, and you were thinking about your obligations.
I wanted my obligations. Auxiliary.
He was thinking about zero. That's
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. There you go. I think, you know, one of the great sort of debates is, I think, too grand a word, but there are, you know, two larger ways of thinking about dictionaries, which are kind of prescriptive and descriptive. Prescriptive is sort of a dictionary is meant to let you know what the rules are of words and languages. And sort of on that side of the spectrum, you might have something like, you know, the Académie Française, which is 100 people whose job it is to say, that word is French, that word is not French. And they could debate for a long time about whether to accept le weekend into the French language.
Right.
And on the other side would be something like, say, urbandictionary.com, which is entirely crowdsourced and which anybody can contribute to. And nobody is telling you what to say or not to say. They are just adding to and enriching your sense of meaning of, I guess, the 21st equivalent of the word fart.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
If you're holding a dictionary in your hands that's printed, as far as I'm concerned, it's a wonderful thing to have, but it's an archival matter simply because words are always changing, whether we like it or not. And so to me, it's like a bundle of Polaroid snapshots. The idea of someone opening the dictionary and saying, this is what the word means, to me is directly equivalent to someone looking at a Polaroid snapshot of me in 1978 with too much hair and, you know, no wrinkles, and saying, that is you. and me saying, oh, well, you're being kind. That's what a word would say if it could watch you opening the dictionary and saying, this is what it is. And so it's always an interesting archive of what the language was, but it can't be what the language is. Urban Dictionary, as much of a hot mess as it is closer to being a record of the language because the language is always moving. That's my feeling about dictionaries.
Well, let me be then, you know, somebody's got to be the boring old fart here, and so let me be that
Please.
Guy.
Yeah.
So, you know, I remember, you know, when I would read sentences like, this book will literally grab you by the throat. And I thought, no, this book will not literally grab you by the throat. This book will you know, do other things, but it won't do that. And I know this because I read the book, and it did not leap up at me that way. And now I go to Merriam-Webster, and the second definition of literally is, in effect, virtually. In Macmillan, the second definition is used when you are describing something in an extreme way that cannot be true. And so what for me is a wild, hilarious, and angry-making misdefinition of a word becomes through usage as acceptable as the one which I would maintain is, okay, I'm going to get in trouble for this, true.
You know how fast describes a rabbit or electricity or rapidity?
Yeah.
Well, then how come you can sit fast? Or if you're fast asleep, probably you are not moving.
Well, and probably so from fasten, right?
Fast means it's opposite. Don't you think that's cool? So how come literally can't do the same thing?
Well, you know, look, I like it when flammable means the same thing as inflammable.
I've always enjoyed
that. Makes me happy.
Exactly. Seeding a watermelon, you know, you're taking the seeds out. You're not putting them in, but you can seed the ground. Well, how come literally can't mean its opposite?
Yeah, and pickle relish is made out of pickles, but hamburger relish is not made out of hamburgers. But before we go down these rabbit holes, I want to take a poll of the audience here. How many of you, when you just feel a certain sense of ennui coming on, will say, I'm bored with this? How many will say, I'm bored of this?
Oh, that's subtle.
Yeah, because I know when I teach at USC in my classes, pretty much anybody under the age of 35 says bored of.
Mm.
I say bored with, and I think, to me, that is the clearest marker of the fact that, as you say, John, when we're reading a dictionary, we're looking at light from a distant star. We're not seeing it. We're seeing the way it was.
I wish I had said that. That's a nice way of putting it. Yeah. Can I have that?
It's yours.
Whenever you mention stars, okay, distant star, now that's good. It's true. Or young people say, based off of what you're saying,
yeah.
To me at 50, I always think, no, based, you know, based on what you're saying. That's just been a random change.
Yeah.
Based off or based on?
Based on.
See? Yeah. But the kids.
But I wouldn't do bored with or bored of. I'd just say boring.
I'm bored with that. Yeah. I'm bored of that.
That boring.
That's yeah, I don't think I've heard either one, but yeah. That's strange.
But even boring old farts like myself will admit that language is always evolving, is always changing. There's always, to use one of John's words, a lot of slippage there, and that the energy of language comes not from its preservation, but from the insurgency of other languages that come in and rub up against what we think of as proper usage and both invigorate it, destroy it, to use that awful Silicon Valley word, disrupt it.
Disruptive.
Yeah.
You know what? I'm going to be obnoxious here.
Please.
It's not so much that it's cultures rubbing up against each other and innovating and disrupting. All of that does change language very much. But there's a cave analogy, and it's not as profound as the Platonic one. If you took a bunch of people, and for some reason you put them in a cave, and they somehow had enough food and oxygen and whatever it is people need to be in there for thousands of years reproducing, but they're always in the cave. If you got them out of the cave in 3,000 years, they would be speaking a brand new language, even though there had been no culture, there had been no conflict, just because language is always ooching along because it has to, because each generation slightly misunderstands the other one. So it's partly the dynamic cultural contact, but it's partly just these little things like based off of and based on, or the fact that, especially in this state, most of this room under 50 talks about I caught a fish instead of I caught a fish. Nobody ever thinks about it, but it's not I caught it, I caught it. A hawk flies in the sky. You make laws. Sushi is raw fish. That's becoming the American way. There's really no more reason why than if I did this, you wouldn't know whether the water would go this way or that way. Multiply that by 5,000 things, next thing you know, you've got a new language. That would happen even in the cave, or like we were all locked in here, you know, for 3,000 years. So that's how inexorable language change is. I like that word. I'm going to keep that. Language change is. And that's why in my next book, Words on the Move, I try to get that concept across, because I think we need to revel in it, because it's like watching the clouds move. You couldn't stop it, and so you learn to enjoy it.
I mean, Mark, you use words, I mean, both for their meaning and also for just everything else about words. I mean, you also use words, the way they look in the page, drained sometimes of all, you know, sort of semantic content.
Did he sell a lot of books for me
out
there?
Words with no meaning.
Delightfully and erotically drained of all semantic
Better.
Content. We'll get there. But when you're choosing your words, are you using the vocabulary that is a kind of fixed, settled vocabulary in your head, or do new words come in, or do words come in with slightly different meaning because you're writing them down?
Sure.
Can you tell us more about that?
Yes.
It's like, you know, a Benny Hill routine.
It is interesting. The creative process of how that happens is, well, to back up, the reason I'm here is that I'm a huge admirer of John, and I have to just say that the only reason I'm here is because of this book and the things that he says. There you go.
Yes.
And I figured at the end I would only get in one question, and here maybe I'll be able to get in like three questions. Because the reason I hesitated was I'm really kind of on the fence about the OED. I have a problem with the OED, and I think it's it. I can liken it to an old flame, because I grew up on the Oxford Concise, and I learned a lot. You know, I learned all the etymologies, how the words like twisted in and out of each other. I was so excited by the British accent that I eventually, you know, detected, and then I kicked it up a notch, and you know, pretty much got married with that two-volume set with the magnifying glass. And I did use it, actually, for all the books. But then something happened to us, and we parted ways. And I thought maybe the flame is still there, just a tiny bit. So this afternoon, I decided to check her out online. And, you know, I found out she's charging $300 a year to look up a word. Good for her. Congratulations, I guess. She said, well, if you're part of the library, then you can use it. So I typed in my library card number. It was not allowed. So then it said, check to see if your library subscribes to the service. I did, and the page link was broken. So I went to Merriam-Webster, and wow, like an old friend, there it was. And I could sort of get in all of that. So John and I don't even have an argument or something to discuss, because I recognize that language changes an enormous amount. So yes, I'll turn to sort of the fonts of research and history that provide this great like ancient Instagram of the way words were and are. But for my new book, The Familiar, for example, takes place with a you know, in Singapore and all sorts of alcoves of LA, and it's forced me to actually go to these places. So going to Singapore was amazing. I was talking to cab drivers about Singlish and how, you know, like using a phrase like Tai Chi La, you know, what does that mean? Okay, well, I know what Tai Chi is, but in fact, it had sort of changed to where it meant he's someone who makes someone else do the work, you know, for him. And so I think in many ways, my early relationship with the dictionary, maybe it's true for all of us, was this intimate relationship where the universe was promised. Everything was there. And then at a certain point, you grew up and you realize, like, oh, I got to get out there. I got to listen to what people are actually saying and how they're using words. And so that's something that I invest myself in every day, you know, when I'm researching and whatnot. And then as the words come together, I realize ultimately I'm paid to make things up, so I can make words up. In fact, I recommend it. I think it's a good practice for everyone. Now and then, just make up a word. It's very liberating.
I mean, in terms of how language changes, there was an recent episode of Girls where Ray Plushansky, the guy who runs the coffee shop.
That AK guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he walks across the street to another coffee shop, and he goes up to the barista and says, "Sir." And the barista says, "Why do you need to call me sir?" And he says, "Female." And the barista says, "Oh, female? Are you a biologist? A biological essentialist?" And he says, "What's going on here?" And the second barista says, "What's going on here is you offended they."
That's not going to work. It's interesting. We really do need to have singular, because for one thing, we have since the 1400s, as far back as I could trace it. And there are pronominal misfits in just about any language. Pronouns are like chinchillas in a cage. They're kind of scooching all around. They don't stay in their places. And singular they is so handy that especially in these times, when that girl scene does reflect something that's really happening, it's good to have it, but it's only going to go so far. You can't use language to change thought. You can only nudge it, but the thoughts have a way of just kind of coming back. It's like rust. And so, for example, if one is of a certain age, you might remember when it was okay to call people crippled. That was considered to be a very humane term. Mm-hmm. It became accreted with the unfortunate feelings that we have about crippled people often, the way somebody would have put it in 1930. Then came handicapped. That's now a rather tacky term. So now we have differently abled. In 25 years, we're going to have to come up with something different because the terms can't change thought. Home relief, welfare, cash assistance, we're about to need a new one. In terms of mental disability, the terms keep going. Steve Pinker calls it the euphemism treadmill. And we often roll our eyes at it, but as long as the thought doesn't change, the language is going to have to keep being changed. They is handy, but frankly, it's interesting. At Columbia, where I teach, this year it has become normal for a student who was born a man to be wearing a dress and have very long hair and lipstick and introduce themselves as, say, Sarah. That's normal. To me, that is changing thought. The part about the they and the z and the other fancy pronouns, you know, we can do that. But it's the reality that has to change. The language can just kind of dance around on the surface, I think.
So let me ask my first question.
Shoot.
I brought a card.
You have cards.
So there's, if you go on Instagram or whatever, there's a quote by me. It says, "Have no fear. You will find your way. It's in your bones. It's in your soul." Now, I said this in Manchester, and it became one of these things that was like populated Facebook, etc. I would never say it's in your soul. So I don't even know what that means. But they took something that I said, and I ended it with "it's in your bones," because I figured, you know, bones, it's the structure that makes you lurch forward. It's the bones of your thought. It's the bones that we're all ultimately going to embrace when we get to death's door. But somehow they wanted to add on this extra phrase and then attribute it to me. So I have a difficulty with soul. In Only Revolutions, I never use the word. I unless a character is saying it, it's a problem for me, okay? It's this kind of amalgamation, and the question is going to veer towards what do we call these kinds of words? Another word is ether, right? In the old days, it was the substance that the heavens were made of. There was humors, remember? That was temperament, humors. Right? Yeah. Humors. Then there's something that you talk about in The Language Host, spontaneous generation, right? That life was just born out of putrid material. Because I consider you an expert in this subject, and also, here we go, here we go. But I want to keep it narrow in terms of your expertise as a linguist. I want to talk about the word race as a word. Okay. And I need help with this word because the problem that I have is that it's another one of these vacant words that's incorrect. It's, you know, if you compared a group that someone might call a race and you looked at their genetic differences, they may be far wider in group members than they would be between one member of one group and one member of another group. It makes no scientific sense. And yet we use it, and in using it, we kind of reinstitute it all the time. We reinstitute this false notion. Even if we decry it, we're constantly reinscribing the falseness of the word, and we keep insisting on this difference that isn't there. Now, the problem I have is that if we eliminate the word, then we are going to potentially disenfranchise a group that is suffering an enormous amount of violence perpetuated by stupid seers who are seized by stupid thinking. So the question is, if we have this word, how do we change it? How do we get away from a word? Because you're right, if we're on the treadmill of euphemism, it's not going to work. We can change it, and it's just going to be code. And we see a lot of kind of, you know, poor coding, you know, in the news today. Mm-hmm. But how do we get away from this kind of, I think, bad repetition? Because I still think thinking can be refined, and by choosing words that are more precise, a thought may be changed. Mm-hmm.
Mark, that's profound, and it goes beyond anything I would call linguistic expertise of mine, but I think I can field it. It's not only a matter of race. I think that in terms of how we talk about it in America, it's also a matter of culture. Mm-hmm. And culture can be a fuzzy concept as well because it's clinal. Nevertheless, I don't think we want to say that it doesn't exist. And many people who would agree that race is a biological concept of no real meaning would resist saying that there is no such thing as a culture, and would resist pretending that they don't belong to a culture. And I think people tend to be happiest when they can think of themselves as belonging to some group that is not another group, even if there's no conflict between them. Of course, we're talking about Black Americans. And so it's less a matter of I belong to a race than I belong to a particular culture. Then there's also, how do you stop talking about race? But then again, the question could also be, how do you keep people from stereotyping based on appearance? That might be a whole different question.
Right.
Really, what was that movie with Warren Beatty that was talked about a little beyond what it should have been in the late 90s?
Dick Bullworth? Tracy.
Bullworth, right, where he had the big...
Written by Jeremy Pixar.
He had the big speech where he talked about how people were just going to blank and blank and blank until everybody was all mixed together,
right,
and that's what would get us beyond the race problem.
That was his wish.
There was something to that, in that I'm not sure we could get beyond the problem that you're talking about without something like that happening, where there was just not any visual basis for the classifications. And then we'd be classists, and we would despise people for saying less books instead of fewer books, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But that is a very knotty problem. There's race, there's culture, there's perception, and there's a natural human desire, I think, to have a we. And I think that all of those things play into all those things. You see, I don't have a glib answer to that, but it's a very interesting question.
In The Language Hoax, you make an argument against a certain way of thinking about language. And if I can sort of characterize what you're arguing against, it's, you know, the limits of my language are the limits of my world. Mm-hmm. The Sapir-Whorf or Whorfianism way of looking at it, which says, mm-hmm, if the Russians have one word for light blue and one word for dark blue, then they actually don't see colors the same way we do. And you do, I think, a pretty effective job of demolishing that.
That idea has to go, and it's unfortunate because it's a very cool idea, the idea that the language that you speak gives you a certain pair of glasses that you see the world through. And, you know, we can tell ourselves that that's why we're learning Arabic, or that's why we're learning any number of languages. But the problem with that is if you take that view and you apply it to just about any language, then you end up calling an awful lot of people in the world dumb. And what I mean by that is, let's say that to be Russian, because there is no one word for blue, you have to either say something as light blue or dark blue. Let's say that that means that blue pops for you more. And then we kind of think, well, boy, that's a neat thing about being Russian. Now, first, you have to ask the question, so what's the worldview from English? You know, it's one thing to look at the other and say, oh, they're fascinating, but what's the worldview from English? And so, you know, Gandhi, Madonna, Mary Tyler Moore, Bono, Sting, all three of us, Paul Hogan, all those people speak English. What's our worldview? Obviously none. And more to the point, a language like Chinese is very telegraphic. If you learn Chinese, you have to learn what not to say. An awful lot of things don't need to be said there. It's nothing like a definite or an indefinite article. You don't really have to express tense very much. It's a language that really keeps it clean compared to English. If you use the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, it means that the Chinese aren't thinking as much as we are. They don't have to mark as many things. I think it's very clear that the Chinese think an awful lot. And so what it means is that you have to let go of the whole idea, because if the Russian blues are popping, and there are all sorts of things you can say about Native American languages in that way, well, they feel the shape of things, etc., then you have to say that almost everybody in Southeast Asia is a little bit dim. And that has always disturbed me. And so I actually sat down and wrote a book about it, and it's there. And I tried to make the point, and thank you for listening to that point.
And he did. And actually, a more vivid example, if I may.
Please.
Improve on what you just said by using what you said.
The book is short, yeah.
So one of the notions I think we've all experienced, whether we've encountered Latin, French, or Spanish, is that notion of gender, right? Something is masculine or something is feminine, right?
Girl.
And so we begin to wonder, well, based on the kind of, you know, attributes that certain objects are given, say, in France, they must be chauvinists, you know, because they're constantly leaning. Like, a group is defined by men as opposed to women. You say il instead of elle. But what John points out is that there is a tribe. I think it's in the Amazon,
the Banawa.
Banawa, right?
Oh,
which opts for feminine, basically, right? It's spontaneously marked feminine language, and it's the feminine pronoun that is used as a choice, right? So here we have a culture that its vernacular is dominated by the feminine, right? And I can't even begin to read. I mean, if you thought fart was bad, what happens to women in this culture is terrible. I mean, it's really awful.
My editor almost had me pull that.
Yeah. And that's one of the things you're suddenly jarred by. You suddenly feel like you have this magic peephole into what a culture is doing simply by the way they are arranging their grammar. And then you discover, oh, wait a minute, they're not connected. And
you said it there.
I think we all innately understand that, but this is a big argument, and this is one of the things that John does in The Language Hoax, is he deracinates this concept that the language is a hold on everything that happens in culture. I have a story, okay? But go ahead.
I want to take the other side of this argument against the two of you, but I want to hear your story first.
Okay, so Victor Niederhofer. Anyone heard that name before? He ran a hedge fund. And in 1996, he decided he was going to invest in Southeast Asia. So he got a guy who was incredibly qualified to judge the economics of Southeast Asia. He was a veterinarian. And he sent him to Thailand. And he says, I want you to look at discarded cigarettes and brothels. That's all I want you to do. And the thinking was that if there were longer butts, it indicated that there was more innate wealth in the country because they were willing to throw their cigarettes away. He reported that there were longer butts. He also reported that all the brothels were clean and safe. So Niederhofer invested hundreds of millions of dollars based on this excellent lexical hypothesis and lost almost all of it. And I tell this story because sometimes we do that with language. We look for there are little markers on our thought, but they are not everything. And so we can come up with crazy ideas about who someone is based on their thinking, and yet we're really way off.
I think we sometimes are way off, but I do think that we can learn a lot about people from their choice of words. I mean, for instance, there's a tribe actually located not very far from here in Hollywood where they have no word for no. They have the words yes and I'll get back to you.
Yeah.
And I think I'm enough of
that
a kind
characterizes
of
them.
Old school Dadaist or letterist to believe that words have meanings that are way above and beyond what their ostensible dictionary-defined meanings are, based on how they sound, based on how they stick in your head. You know, even if they were made of the same thing, eating a snickerdoodle is not the same thing as eating a vine.
Right. No. Although, I'm going to give you something that agrees with you somewhat and pushes back a little bit against myself in terms of what a worldview is. This is a table. That's not what I wanted to tell you. But in French or Spanish, this thing is feminine. It's a girl somehow. Experiment has shown that if you ask a French speaker or a Spanish speaker how a table would talk if it was a cartoon character, then much more than could be an accident, a French or a Spanish speaker imagines the table talking with a high voice. As opposed to an English, I think probably our sense would be that I think of this as male if I have to. If it said hello, it would talk like Brian the dog on Family Guy. But for French or Spanish speakers, the table talks like this. Mm-hmm. That has to be because it's a feminine noun. Now, is that their worldview? If you're a French or a Spanish speaker, do you walk around thinking of this as a gendered object? I don't think so. Nevertheless, there are interesting experiments like that. I just wanted to put that out there.
Yeah, no, but I just like the way that words escape their meanings and come to mean other things because of what they're... what's the example? When we moved to Los Angeles, you know, it took me a while to realize that, you know, I thought San Vicente and San Vicente were the same street.
Right.
It turns out they're not. And when my son was, you know, very, very young, just because of the sounds of the word, he assumed that Chevy Chase, the street you'll find in Glendale, and Cesar Chavez, which is the street you'll find in East L.A., were the same street. Just sort of, he'd never seen the continuation. And because of that, he assumed also that Chevy Chase and Cesar Chavez were the same person. Now, I don't think he would have ever made that leap had it not been for the words, because I don't think there was anything
true in
the concept of those streets.
Yes. Or,
yeah.
And so, yes, that is certainly an example where language can influence thought. But I assume that he has let go of the idea that Chavez and Mr. Chase were the same person.
You would have to ask him.
College. Yeah.
I mean, I think one of the things we're sort of dancing around a little is, or at least you kind of were bringing this up, is also just the sound of things.
Sure.
You know, and I was at an interesting gathering that made me feel very uncomfortable, and yet it was kind of enlightening. And so it's problematic, but I'm going to put this in your direction as well. Everyone had gotten drunk. These were all white people, by the way. And suddenly someone thought it was a good idea to do an accent, right? So suddenly we had Apu from The Simpsons appearing, right?
Be careful about accents.
And exactly. And suddenly we had a Scottish guy, and we had a Russian guy. There were no blacksents, but there were many accents that were on the verge of offensive. Now, I'm going to vouch for these people. You know, their intention wasn't racial. If anything, it was musical. And there was a great amount of jocularity and joviality. And the cleverness that happened was that the one who was doing the Indian accent claimed that, in fact, he was from Australia, and he was doing an Australian. He was an Australian, and this is how they talk. And the Scottish one was from Russia. And so what was being grabbed at, and I know this feeling, and I know we've all experienced it too, is that there is a joy in accents. There's a joy in the musicality of speech. What is that? You can't see it in a dictionary. In a dictionary, it deprives us of the music of speech. As someone, you know, who writes novels, I know that you can kind of imply music by the way you sort of create a cavalcade of phrases and long sentences and pacing and whatnot. But as a linguist, what do we do with music?
It's intonation, which is as crucial to getting meaning across as the things that we think about, because they're what you can put on a page. Right. And it's why, for example, Howard, with all due understanding, the literally issue isn't a problem, because intonation gets across what we mean so often, as does context. Language is always taking place within a context of shared meanings. And so, for example, the word totally as used today. If you say, she's totally going to come, as people under a certain age do, that doesn't mean she's going to come in a complete fashion. Mm-hmm. That's not what totally means. Totally has a very coded meaning that you could never be taught. If a child asked you what totally meant, you'd say completely, which it can. But she's totally going to come is what you say if both of you know that there are people who would think that she wasn't going to come, but you two have reason to believe that she will. Oh, she's totally going to come. Or Taylor Swift concert. Oh, we're totally going to get tickets. That totally implies that you think of Taylor Swift as being probably somebody that maybe people a little younger or less musically tutored might like, but there's something about her that you like anyway. And so even if somebody might think it was a little tacky, you're going to get Taylor Swift tickets. Right. In other words, language comes with context. All of that we miss because as print people, we assume that language is just that. To be a person who lives in writing is to live in a, I mean, I would never give it up. I live in writing. I can't remember anybody's name unless I see it written down. But that is not what language was designed for. Language was designed for this.
Right.
And also short, messy sentences and eye contact. That's an artifice. If language had only existed for 24 hours, writing came along at 11:07 p.m. That's how late writing is. Language is this. So that's what you're getting at, the music of language, which is inseparable from actually communicating.
But at a certain point, it separates from it. That's what's interesting. And it becomes music. Yeah. It becomes this binding thing.
To the point where I can get rid of the words.
Yeah,
and I think sometimes it converges, too.
Yeah.
If you're on a good day.
Well, Beethoven, right? The convergence at the end of the ninth is the word, right? You know.
So in terms of this kind of stuff, both in terms of the musicality of language, in terms of the honing of meaning of language, in terms of the delightful separation of word simply weighed down by its meaning and word sort of allowed to exfoliate in all kinds of weird and yeah, like dandruff.
I know what you mean. Yeah. No, that's a good use.
So whose job is it to do these things? Is it the job, I mean, Mallarmé, talking about Edgar Allan Poe, said it's the job of the poets, you know, to purify the language of the tribes.
Right.
I mean, that's what poets, you know, donner un sens plus pur au mot de la tribu.
Purity always makes me a little uncomfortable, but, you know, if you want to go there.
There are people who would say it's the job of dictionaries to do that. There are people who say it's nobody's job. It's just going to happen, so you may as well either accept it on the one end or revel in it on the other. Well, there are people who would say it's lexicographers' jobs. There are people who would say it's linguists' jobs to sort of, you know, keep a close watch on the heart of language.
I mean, I think one of the things that John was just getting at is there is a difference between speech and writing, and the experience of reading is very different from listening. And, you know, you had this wonderful talk, which you can find online, about texting and how texting is actually a kind of speech.
I looked obese.
We're talking. He looked fine. He really did. Okay.
Just one day.
But there is something about writing where you suddenly see yourself, where a thought can be constructed that has many parts. It goes beyond seven parts. It can be very complicated. And that act of hearing allows change. And that's one of the things that Harold Bloom writes about when he talks about Shakespeare, is that one of the things that Shakespeare did that was so monumental was that the characters began to listen to themselves. They listened to what they were saying, and they changed their mind. And I think what we're kind of getting at is that changing your mind is also how speech changes. It's when you suddenly arrive at a new thought that it demands a new kind of music, a new set of words, a new, you know, a new sense of the world around us.
I agree with that, and writing and speech are completely different things. Linguists pay more attention to speech for various historiographical reasons. And I would say in terms of having to watch it, I am not a libertine sort of person. I'm anal as hell. I'm a neatnik. I do not have my food mixing together on the plate. I do not let it all hang out. So that's not where any of this is coming from. But in terms,
John, your duck confit was pretty messy.
Was the messiest food tonight. And all those beans. But notice I kept wiping my mouth.
Yeah, I did notice.
But the language, it doesn't need to be watched because the things that it's doing are always so complicated. And so, for example, this new expression, I just can't even. Okay, what does even mean? Now, to the extent that you can't even begin to describe what it means, I read an academic article explaining what even means in general.
It's an intensifier like ass.
But not quite, actually. Ass is an intensifier. And so if you say, that's a gray-ass squirrel, then it actually means it's counter-expectation. It means that you didn't expect it to be gray. But
oh, right.
Even,
yeah.
She even had a horse. Well, it doesn't mean that she had a horse in a way that was level, and it doesn't mean she had a big horse. It doesn't mean that she, on a day when she felt obese, had a horse. What does it even mean? I read a 50-page article once explaining what it meant with all this math. It gave me a headache. I needed a drink. And that's colloquial speech. And so I'm not trying to be a bully or anything, but why does it need to be watched? It's like a cat. It's like a cat's going to make a mess. But really, the cat's just cute. That wasn't a good analogy. But it's what are we afraid
it
the language
wasn't,
is going to do?
I study my cats.
I wasn't
cats,
thinking of watching a surveillance. I was thinking of watching in the way that Johnny Cash says, I keep a close watch on this heart of mine.
Okay.
So what's your fascination with language then?
Yeah.
That something, we can be so unaware of something so complicated and do it so well. That's what gets me about
right.
it. You just listen to anybody on the street.
Yeah.
You think, hey, yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And so I was listening to somebody who was, you know, slovenly, unpleasant, too loud on their cell phone several years ago, talking about they have pistre, pistre, pistre. And I was thinking, what is pistre, pistre? And I listened closely, and I looked at them and kind of used context. It took me about an hour. I thought, that person was saying that they have repeat stress syndrome, but they're putting the accent on the repeat because when something becomes an established concept, the accent jumps back. Right. So that if you listen to your great-grandfather, he'll say that he got air conditioning. Well, as time went by, it became air conditioning. Oh. You can hear that always happening. And I thought, oh, it's happening to repeat stress. And this person is saying repeat stress. Now, this person probably didn't go to college, was not a careful speaker, yet they have that rule in their head. Pistre, pistre. That, to me, is why I like language.
Yeah.
That really is what keeps somebody going.
And do you get excited, mystified, or is it all part of the same package when you realize, like, in one sense, one of the reasons we have dictionaries is to clarify thinking, right? We want to create, we want to know that we know the same definitions, that we're using the language in the same way so we can part the veil of what it is we're involved with, right? That's one aspect. The other aspect is that we want to hide things from people, you know, Cockney slang. We invent terms to purposely obfuscate, you know, certain things that we're discussing from other people. So language is this organ that in one sense it's you know, it's revealing, it's, and in another it's trying to hide. Like, how does that situate in your linguistic mind?
Yeah.
It does.
Yeah.
I'm always interested in how well we communicate rather than the extent to which
we hide.
Don't do it properly. If we don't do it properly, often it's...
But I'm not saying not properly. We're doing it properly, but we're purposely hiding from someone else something.
Purposely.
Yeah.
When do we do that?
All the time. I mean, you know, one of the things that we teach in cinema school is, you know, the camera's job is to reveal what the character doesn't want you to know.
Okay.
The easiest way to show in screenplay format, and it's a big cliche, and it's an awful cliche at this point. If you want to show that a character is having the worst day of their life, somebody says, "How are you?" and they say, "Fine."
But it's what you show while they're saying "fine,"
or right? What
or do you
or
just
what,
mean as scripting simply.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it also can simply mean like when a group of kids don't want another, you know, member of that group to come along, so they say, "We're going to go to the movies," when they're really going to the party. But through intonation and words like totally, et cetera, they can communicate to one another that they're not going to the movie, and they can excise someone from the group.
I see that as successful communication.
Right, yeah. Right. That's what I was saying. But yeah. I'm just saying language is put in the service of revealing, and then language is put in the service of hiding.
Sure, yeah. But it's being put to a service, and it's doing the job. So to the extent that you have something where you can deceive as well as communicate information, that's why what we're doing is so far beyond what any chimpanzee or bonobo can do with sign language.
Right.
The real essence of language is, I mean, there are people who are working on this now who I've been reading over the past few years because they're coming up with really interesting stuff. One of the essences of language is the fact that you can deceive with it and in subtle ways like that, and not just by hiding the coconut behind your back. So it's effective. That deception is effective. It makes it part of the fun.
Derrida even took it a step further, and he said, the human is the only creature that can lie with the truth.
Okay.
So you're at a fork in a road. Someone went that way. Someone's coming to chase that person. And you can look at him and go, yeah, he went that way.
Yeah.
To mislead the person into going the other way.
Exactly. That's what we do
with
this thing that we have.
We do want to open it up to questions from the audience, but before we do, I just have a couple of quotes that I came across that I would love to get your sense of. One is from Toni Morrison, who said that we use words to fend off the scariness of things with no names. Is that a fear you experience, or do you think that we as humans experience? Do you think it's terrifying that we have things?
That's a little gnomic for me. Mark, that's you.
I don't mess with Toni Morrison. She's got it. It's fine with me. She says it's true.
Well, you know,
Things that we're scared of. What did she say again?
Words fend off the scariness of things with no names. And here, I'll get on to the sort of less gnomic part. But used faithfully and correctly, words can limn the actual, imagined, and possible lives of its speakers, readers, and writers. Words can never pin down slavery, genocide, or war, nor should language yearn for the arrogance to be able to do so. Its force, its felicity, is its reach toward the ineffable.
But reach towards,
yeah.
Because it can never completely accomplish the task. That's definitely true. Language is imperfect.
Well, I think part of why we use words, to get back to the first part, is to have a sense of control, you know, by naming something, you know, Adam names things to control
essence
animals,
of language,
right?
Yeah.
So when we're scared of something, by giving it a shape, by limiting it with syllables, it gives us at least an illusion of control, you know. In fact, I had a quote. We're going to go quote unquote. So mine was from Yang Wan Li, who said, "What is poetry? If you say it's simply a matter of words, I will say a good poet gets rid of words. If you say it's simply a matter of meaning, I will say a good poet gets rid of meaning. But if you say, if words and meaning are gotten rid of, where is the poetry? To this I reply, get rid of words and meaning, and there is still poetry." That was written in 1200.
Wow,
you gonna mess with that?
I'm not gonna mess with that.
I won. All right.
You know, I'm still wondering what the collective noun is for a group of drunk white people. Is it a pride of something?
Pride.
Yeah. And, you it's know, a is frat. It
an
it?
Anthology.
Yeah. Had that word for years. Avoid at all cost.
An anthology of prose.
Yeah.
So we're going to open up. now that we've exhausted language, we're going to open it up to the audience for questions. Okay.
That was a delightful discussion. In fact, I listened to John on a great courses.
Thank you.
Yeah, for 10 hours or whatever, half an hour.
I have never listened to one second of those.
For sure to see you. I have a, first of all, by my accent, you see I'm a foreign-born American. I've been here for 40 years. And I still have a problem with the concept of gender. And I raised the issue with Marx's statement about being sociological and political implications of a gender. Now, English is also Latin-derived language, which has a gender. And all nouns are female or female end with A. So if I say, I had a lunch with a friend, my wife would ask, was it a she or he? Why does she have to ask a second question? Why don't I say, I had a lunch with a frienda? Rather a friend. So this is incongruities or illogicalities which only foreigner can appreciate, and a native-born American has nothing wrong thinking I had a lunch with a friend. The same thing with the other objects. There was a guy who told me, oh, my thumb, she is hurting like a Dickens. I said, well, she, he, what is that? New York is he, Florida is she, Columbia is she. This is in our perspective. So I'm inviting you to comment on my what I'm saying. Mark, John?
You don't need that. And I don't mean that as any disrespect to your native language, but as natural as that prissiness about gender seems, it's something that certain languages in the world do and certain languages of the world don't. And one can get along because of context. And so every now and then there'll be an exception, such as I had lunch with a friend. And so that's one way that in a language like English, you can hide something. Although there, you know, there are other cues. You know, I had lunch with a friend. Very often an English speaker can tell what the gender of the friend was just from the smell of the way the person says it. But still, it's not as polite as Freund and Freunde. But you'd be surprised what a language can do without. So for example, if by any chance your native language was German, in this language, there's a difference between I'm going to school tomorrow, I'm going to go to school tomorrow, I will go to school tomorrow, and I go to school tomorrow. In my experience, Germans and people speaking related languages have the hardest time with that. You know that a German has gotten absolutely perfect when they never mess up the English future. Now, we don't even think of it. You don't need to have such a subtle difference. A German person once said to me, whose English was spectacular, I turned 31. And what she meant was, I'm turning 31. It's so subtle and so utterly unnecessary. So, about a third of the world's languages have no grammatical gender of that kind, and they're doing just fine. All the languages that do have it developed it by accident. And so as dandy as it seems, it's just a frill. Most of what's in any language is a frill, including distinguishing between he and she, which most languages don't. It's a funny thing. Your own language feels normal, but it never is.
Is that the only sort of anthropic trait? Like, is there ever like a tough word versus a weak word? Or, you know, like, I mean, is it just gender? Is that it? Is there any other sort of...
Well, in many languages, it's not just male and female, but it's male, female, round, skinny, animal, abstract concept. And so just male and female is a primitive way of doing it.
Right.
Male, female, neuter, that's a European fetish.
Right.
In other languages, it'll be male, female, animal, and the other stuff. And then in a great many African languages in particular, it's this dazzling array of things, and then half of the words are irregular. That's what.
Wow.
That's how languages really work.
Right, right. You learn the rules of language, and then you learn the exceptions to the rule, you know, sort of, batteries not included.
It's ridiculous, yeah. Estonian has no rules, for example.
But I think the more practical answer is that, for the reason that you can't say I had lunch with a frienda, is because words that end frienda. With A have all been trademarked by automobile and drug companies.
Yeah. Splenda, that's right.
Zyprexa Daewoo Nubira.
Depressing.
I really like the idea that because people don't have words, they don't feel less or they don't think less. And I took interest in that, that my grandmother, for example, was illiterate, but yet because she didn't speak or read, did not feel in a less complex way than anybody else. But I work in LA with three jobs that have to do with language. The first one is I'm a simulcast translator for the local news, for KTLA 5.
I'm sorry.
It's fascinating. It's language in the raw. I get to do police chases. I get to do the crime beat, the night beat.
I'm glad you like that. Wow.
Well, the language, like, we even take a lot of anglicisms and put it into Spanish, and I take pride in speaking Spanish and making sure that the words come out in Spanish. And, for example, I don't know, the eye of God of the police helicopters is el ojo de Dios, which doesn't even exist in Spanish, but exists to the people who speak Spanish here. And what I want to say, and then there are words that, as I translate, I notice that Spanish is a much more verbose language. It's impossible to translate word for word what we're saying in the news. I have to take shortcuts. And I notice that Spanish uses just a plethora of words, whereas English gets to the point much more quickly. And I notice when I'm translating that words matter. Like, in English, they use Republicans to mean conservatives. But in Spanish, Republicans mean people who stand for the Republic. So I have to say in Spanish, the people from the Conservative Party say this and that. And I guess that even though I take solace and I like the idea that people who are not well-read feel the same or think the same, I can't help but notice also in my other jobs in film that there are cultural differences. If I'm speaking Spanish and I get straight to the point on something, people get offended. I have to ask about their day. I have to ask about how they're doing. I have to make an emotional observation first. And if I do that in English, people get exasperated. People are like, ask the question first and then say, I hope you have a nice day. It was great to like see your cousin or whatever. So I tend to think that languages do have a personality, although maybe that's just me.
Cultures have personalities, but it's not the structure of the language. And so many Spanish speakers will say to me, I say, me gustan las manzanas. And we say, I like apples. Well, that means that I think of the apples as pleasing me, whereas you think of yourself as actively liking all over the apple. I repudiate that. However, yes, there are differences in culture, without a doubt. Yes. And to speak American English is to get to the point. Yes, we are curt. We don't care. I'm sorry.
Next question.
This is for both of you. As writers who are both proponents of the evolution of language and the singular use of language, I'm curious what you think about the editing process. After you write your manuscript and you hand it off to another language user, how open are you to suggestions from an editor and just how open are you to that process?
Are you talking about translation or just...
No, if you submitted a manuscript to your publisher,
right,
the editor is working on it, as someone who really believes in like the singular use of language and that it's
right,
evolving, how open are you to somebody else coming in and having influence on your manuscript?
Well, I think what I was getting at was that language is something, as a writer, that you have to work through eventually. You have to let go of it. You have to know its rules, and then you have to abandon it. You have to get out in the world and realize that it's just a tiny figment of this human, you know, cognition that is assembling a sense that can be communicated to people in this room. I mean, one of the larger questions that I wish we could get into, we don't have time, is really what context means, you know. And one of the things that writing about a girl who finds a cat has moved me towards is this question of animality. And so animality is when you begin to look at not just the language of what we're talking, of what we're sharing, each of us, but actually the language of an entire ecosystem. You know, there's a guy out there, I think he's Krauss, and he goes out and he records ecosystems. And you can just hear as you listen to this.
Like the rainforest.
There are problems. Like things have changed, you know? And this is the way the trees are moving, the insects are talking. You know, there's this wonderful book called How Forests Think by Eduardo Cohn, and he talks about the semiotics of the forest, of literally the jungle, of how, you know, of how, yes, there are signs everywhere. Life is signs, you know? And so when a twig drops, it's communicating to something else. And it's not just reactive, it's complicated in the sense that a jaguar has to guess where its prey is going to be. It's not just merely that the prey is here, but it has to figure that out. Now, the reason I'm going into this is because if you get too attached to your words in the editorial process, you're missing the big picture. You know, it is a conversation that you're having with your editor. It is a conversation that you're having with your readers. It is a conversation that you're having with this world out there that doesn't speak that language. And I think if the one thing we can sort of distill out of this evening is that it's constantly shifting. So to be too fastened, you know, to something that moves really fast in universal time is to misunderstand this glorious stuff that we're able to inhabit.
Mark, what state did you grow up in, if I may?
All over the place. Born in New York City, went to public high school in Utah, was the only non-Mormon there. Then back east, I've been here for 20 years. I claim it my home, so.
This is the joy of language. This is going to seem so random. The animal jaguar, the car jaguar. In California, 20 years ago, it was noticed that it was common for people subconsciously to call the animal a jaguar and the car a jaguar. One could walk around and say, what do you call that car? A jaguar. What is in the jungle? A jaguar. Oh, it was interesting. More and more, I'm noticing that now the animal is becoming a jaguar, too. You said jaguar.
I did.
This is how we chart how language changes, and I think that is the neatest thing.
The worst thing, though, is you got to help me out here. I censored it, because the first impulse was jaguar.
See, you...
I did. In New York, I always was taught to say rather, and I have always said rather, because, you know, when you go to the West...
The way they'd rather be? Oh, Jesus Christ.
I would rather do this, please.
Linguists listen to
the syllabic
stuff
change, yeah.
Like that. You know what I wanted to say. And it's a joy to hear it changing every 10 years. Yeah. Anyway, sorry to derail it with that. Yeah. What he said, I don't like editing very much. I like the way I write, but you have to just deal with it. Often an editor will find things that are useful. Copy editors get worse every year for some reason. Now that I'm getting a little older, I always tell mine, leave in the singular they's. Just stop. And it's becoming easier to say that. But otherwise, you just submit to it because life is hard.
Yeah. And because
what he said.
The basic human urges are toward food, shelter, and changing somebody else's copy.
Yep. Yep.
Next time for two more?
Okay, time for two more, and I'll let you pick them.
All right. My question has to do specifically... about the indefinite article A and N followed by a word that begins with an H. I grew up and thinking it was an historical event, but I noticed that Rachel Maddow, who went to Oxford, I think, she always pronounces the A in the hard H, a historical event. And I didn't know if that was now where we're going with that or... Is there still hope that there's a silent H out there and
tell
that
us
we
about the hard
say
H.
The N article?
So if you wanted to say an historical event, what's another example? Because you wouldn't say I'm living in an house. You know, it's not like Eliza Doolittle. So an historical event. What else? And I want you to understand I'm not making fun of you in any way. But... some of these things are affectations, kind of like rather, that are passed down.
I beg your pardon.
What's really happening to A and Ann is a elephant, a airplane, where people use the A before a word with a vowel, because you don't pronounce airplane beginning with a vowel, you pronounce it beginning with a consonant, which is the glottal stop. Notice that I say airplane. I couldn't say airplane. That wouldn't be English. You have to say airplane. So even a toddler says airplane, and she's following, thinking of my own daughter, following the rules of English where you say A before a consonant such as airplane. That's happening. The historical, I never noticed Rachel Maddow saying ahistorical, but I say ahistorical. Anhistorical has always been a beautiful little Philip. F-I-L-L-I-P.
It's a good one. I like that word.
You have a Philip.
Yeah. In French, they make the distinction between H, which is H, and H aspiré.
Right.
And they put, there are different rules for what elides into them,
right,
depending
the
on
exactly.
whether it's an H or an aspirated H, even though you can't really hear the, if you're a non-native speaker, you can't hear the difference between those two H's.
I remember that.
You reject that?
I got a BA in French, and I just said no. Even I just thought that's clearly something somebody made up. It's very complicated.
Well, then, you know.
Let it go. Let it go.
You can see I'm still
change
upset.
With us right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, right. right. Embrace it.
Embrace it.
Last question? Right
yeah.
Hi. For a number of years, I supervised the adaptation of American film dialogue into European languages. And I certainly didn't try to impose English vocabulary on European viewers, although there was some adaptation of cultural references. But outside of my work was when I really discovered what was going on with English in Europe. So I was in the Frankfurt airport waiting for a plane, and a man rushed up to a woman who they were both very glad to see each other, and he said, "Ah, das war sehr gutes Timing." And so that was my first, English, creeping in. And then on the internet, I happened on a German website which instructed me to click in hier, bitte. So my question is about the influence that English is having on other languages. Do you have anything general to say about that?
Mark, first, do you have anything?
I'm an expert on that, clearly. I make things up. So I'm going to turn this one over to you, John.
Okay. I just wanted to see. It's having quite an impact. I was in Tokyo for some reason last summer, and I remember being very jet-lagged and sitting on the train and occasionally forgetting that I was not in New York because there's so much English. Words are clothes upon grammar. And so Japanese is still utterly impenetrable to us, and I mean the spoken language, because the grammar is still Japanese, and most of the vocabulary is very much still Japanese. But yeah, English is everywhere. English is eating up most of the world's languages, and it is really infusing other vocabularies. Now, of course, probably half of the words that I have said tonight were from French or Latin. And none of us are wishing that I was speaking Old English, which was basically German. These things happen, but I can imagine being German now or Japanese and finding it a little odd how many of these American, it's not English, American words are coming in. But really, a language is its grammar. Japanese has different word order. Japanese is Japanese. But yeah, it's there.
So question, actually, because one thing we didn't really kind of creep into at all is really the future. What about technology in terms of technology's ability soon, perhaps, to translate languages effectively to the point that we won't listen to other languages? You know, we'll just speak English and some algorithms are going to start translating into Japanese. So we'll have this ability, perhaps, to talk more clearly with another person, but we will begin,
what gets lost.
We'll begin to silo the languages. Because we won't learn the other language.
It's hard to imagine how it would get better than 90%, but that'll be enough that there will be much less reason to learn new languages
right.
in 100 years.
Yeah.
That's here.
So
devices already exist.
Are you saying that pigeons and creoles aren't going to spontaneously generate themselves anymore?
That will never happen again. Nobody's ever asked me, but there'll be no reason for a pigeon to become a creole because there will be this instant communication, which will get cheaper and cheaper. So, yeah.
That's wow. So no more... Charmander becoming Charizard.
That's over.
Keep going, Howard.
That's it. So we have to end this part of the evening. I mean, I want to talk about the things we take for granted, which is, you know, we certainly take words, we take language for granted. I mean, we use it, I would say, 95% of the time without thinking about it, until we get stuck. I mean, you're reading and you look at this word, blah, 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 he, and then it's S-A-I-D, and it's like, he said, what is this thing? And then you notice that word everywhere, and you don't know what it means, and then you don't know what any of the other words mean. And then all of a sudden, you're sort of outside of language, looking at it from the outside.
What situation is this? No, I missed a stitch where you can't read.
Okay. Well, like
he was at a bar. He'd had a few drinks.
Right. Yeah. Right. I was drinking with a bunch of white guys, and trying to read
a frat. A frat of you.
A frat of you.
Yeah.
And I was reading some dialogue that had blah blah blah. He said. He said. He said. And then the word "said" just somehow lost its meaning and became this collection of letters that wasn't even pronounced the way it looked. And then it spread, sort of like a virus or a rhizome, and none of the words really made sense to me. Anymore.
Let him go, man. Let him go.
I haven't had an experience since roughly 1985. And
what was the drug?
They told us really? They dosed one of these, and now we know.
But you're saying, well, like that happens to all of us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Help me here.
Yeah. Case in point.
Okay, what I'm saying, let me just like reel this back before like I get made fun of by my betters here. So we take language for granted most of the time, but you know, there's lots of things that we actually need to think about and thank. And here's the transition, and this is not going to work now, but let's try for this. I think for events like this, there's a lot of stuff that goes on that we don't think about, too. We don't think of the work of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles.
Absolutely.
And without which none of this with seeming ease wouldn't happen at all. Without which none of this would happen at all.
It was an interesting negative there.
There we go.
There.
Yeah.
That was a great trick.
You did like that. He caught it way before both of us, but I got it.
I would also, I think we don't think enough about the institution of libraries in general, the place that there are these temples of words that we can go to enlighten ourselves or to worship, and they're just there for us. We don't really pay for them. We don't really think about the work of all of the people who make them possible in all kinds of ways. So before we leave, in addition to thanking Mark and John for giving of their time, I would like to thank all the people, either who you don't see or who you don't think about or who aren't here, that make this whole larger structure possible. Want to read, in closing, a couple sentences from Don DeLillo. It's his book, The Names, and they're standing outside the Parthenon. People came through the gateway, people in streams and clusters, in mass assemblies. No one seems to be alone. This is a place to enter in crowds, seek company, and talk. Everyone is talking. I move past the scaffolding and walk down the steps, hearing one language after another, rich, harsh, mysterious, strong. This is what we bring to the temple, not prayer or chant or slaughtered rams. Our offering is language. Thank you.
No. Good night. Nice.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.